Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and the 12 steps. Produced, hosted, and posted by people in recovery who've been given strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right, so one thing we haven't been doing on this podcast, and what I hear other people do, they always have this very specific intro, and it's so well done, and they do it the same way each time. And well, damn it, we're not that organized. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that. I just started off with I'm Christian. This is the Most High Show, and kicking it with Brian Eicher.
Bam. That's correct.
Got it. And Brian, you're a licensed social worker?
Not fully licensed yet. I have my LMSW, which is Licensed Masters of Social Work.
Yeah.
And then to be fully licensed, you have to take an exam. And then you would be what's called an LCSW, which is a licensed clinical social worker.
So how much school have you had to take to get to that point?
I have an undergraduate degree. And then I got my master's in social work. Wow. So that's, roughly
8 years?
No, six years. Yeah.
Wow. That's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the what's the difference between like a social worker and a counselor?
What kind of counselor are you talking about? Like a licensed professional counselor?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that they're, in theory, they're, I don't know if social workers or counselors would agree with me, but in theory, they're kind of the same thing if mm-hmm. they're performing the same job as right. a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
But counselors, professional counselors, if they're licensed professional counselors, typically go to school to become counselors, to become professional counselors.
Mm-hmm.
Social workers, a lot of times, not all social workers go to school to become like counselors or right. therapists, quote unquote. There are a lot of different avenues that social workers can take. I mean, a lot of times I think people have a preconceived thought that a social worker is like a defects worker or a state employee.
Yeah.
And social workers can do that. They can, they can work for the state, they can work for schools, which is the state, they can work for a lot of different agencies as a social worker, where a licensed professional counselor might not have that ability.
Mm-hmm.
But technically, when it comes to therapy, like in a private practice setting or a treatment facility, they are technically the same thing.
Yeah. So what made you go for that and not like counseling?
I had a mentor when I was getting my undergraduate degree, when I made the decision that I wanted to pursue this career. Mm-hmm. And he was actually a licensed professional counselor. And he mentioned that, if he could have done it again, if he could have kind of done it all over again, he probably would have got his master's in social work
because
it's not as limiting. Uh-huh. And he was in private practice, and he just mentioned that, he wanted to kind of do some other stuff, and having his LPC limited him a little bit in that regard. So he suggested, or he kind of gave me some advice and said that he would have recommended me getting my master's in social work.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you went with that route.
Yeah, but my intent was always to be in private practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one-on-one kind of...
Yeah, individual therapy and couples.
Yeah.
That was kind of what it was really just individual therapy, but then kind of down the line, it was also working with couples too.
Mm-hmm.
But servicing people, individuals and couples with addiction, marriage issues, and depression, anxiety, mental health. But that's kind of the population that I service. That's
pretty much America.
Yeah. Yeah. The world.
Yeah. Right? So what was it like, cause that's a very, I think you're called to that in a sense.
Sure.
Right. when was it in your life that you were like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and spend the next 6 years doing this, getting this so that I can, you know, get to the point where I can help, you know, or do whatever. What was it that made you decide to go down that path, you know?
Yeah. I was working at a sober living facility. It was a halfway house in Smyrna, and Smyrna, Georgia. And I was a resident manager. And so I did a lot of like night checks on the guys, make sure they were in their rooms, make sure that they, you know, weren't like skipping curfew. And I would do like drug screens and ask them how their day was going, ask them if they were going to like 12-step meetings and if they were talking to their sponsor, stuff like that. And I was a sophomore in my undergraduate degree, and I decided that I was going to be a history major. And I don't like, because I liked history, but I was like, I don't know what I want to do, you know?
Right, right.
And I was taking like some chemistry classes and stuff, and that really sucked. And I thought I was going to go to med school. And when I started taking chemistry, I found out really quick that wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Cause I was really bad at chemistry. And when I was working at that halfway house, you work one-on-one with guys in their like environment, and like they're exposed, you know, they're just like, they're just getting sober, or they're like depressed and anxious from their like getting out of treatment and having a lot of like, issues going on with their families, and they're just, they have a lot going on. And I got to work with guys doing that.
Yeah.
And I found out really quickly, I don't know about really quickly, but just through that process, it was apparent to me that that was what I wanted to do, that I wanted to continue that in some fashion, but have a career out of it, because being a resident manager at a halfway house, I wasn't going to be able to support my family, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So,
or get a lift on your truck.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of like where it clicked. Like you kind of were in the trenches of it.
Yeah, and exactly. Yeah. That term is actually, there's another mentor of mine that used to use that term, the trenches. Yeah,
the trenches. Yeah. Well, the thing that's amazing to me about that, and like it took me so long to get this. But like, if that's where you fall in love with it, that it makes so much sense, because I think there's sometimes I fall in love with the idea of something and then I commit myself to achieving that, or in my past I've done that. And then I get halfway through, or I get three quarters way through, and I'm like, this is hard and this sucks. And I lose interest.
Sure.
I think it's partially because I'm kind of like the idea of it, or the idea of me doing that, and not actually the trenches of it. And like when I'm in seminary right now, and it's an interfaith seminary, and you know, it's made sense because I really get something out of helping people connect with whatever God is, you know? And so it's different than in the past, some of the things I've pursued, you know, because I pursued them because I liked the idea of it, not actually like what it was going to take every day to do it, you know? So that's cool. It kind of makes it a genuine pursuit. So you mentioned you work with addicts, and you know, that's kind of one of the things we do is talk about that. And we try to create awareness and in and around the stigma of addiction. And it's, lately what's been kind of coming up is the stigma of recovery, right? And when someone is in recovery, because I, you know, maybe it's because we're doing this show, but I find a lot of people are living more openly in their recovery than maybe they did when, you know, 20, 30 years ago. More people are open about it. Plus, a lot more people are dying every day. So
you mean like as far as like talking to people about
That they're in recovery?
Sure.
Right? You hear that more often. It's become more socially acceptable, and it's becoming more the norm. Partially because it's a, you know, health crisis, right? So so many people affected by it. So when people enter into this world of recovery, right, and they're they're living this life of recovery, there's this stigma that gets put on us.
Sure.
Those of us who are in recovery. And what I've found in the recovery community is an authentic group of people who truly love you and will, you know, do almost anything they can to help you.
Within the community. Sure.
But then you get these people who are outside of the community and they're looking at it and they just think we're just a bunch of drug addicts.
Sure.
So how, like, when you're in your practice, like, how often do you find that coming up? Like, this kind of being a person in recovery as a part of their identity and who they are.
Yeah. I think more so with individuals who are early on, you know, under a year, under 6 months, who maybe have gotten a new job or maybe are meeting new people in school or meeting new people going back to work in the workforce, right? Mm-hmm. And they're very outspoken, like, about being in recovery or being an addict or being an alcoholic. And that can have they can get a lot of pushback from that, or they might not get a job because of that, or they may, you know, find that people tense up because of that. Mm-hmm. And when they process those things, I caution people to protect that part of themselves, mm-hmm. you know, because what you talked about, I found with others, they say the same thing, that there is a community for them that embraces that.
Yeah.
They embrace recovery and they embrace anonymity. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And that is a really important part of recovery.
Yeah.
Because there is still a huge stigma. But I think that as people get sober, get clean, and are in recovery for a longer period of time, they start to understand who those people are in their lives and who they can trust with that.
Right.
And they understand those boundaries a little bit more. But it is kind of, I think it can be kind of loose for people in the beginning. But they, you know, it is kind of a trial and error, I think, or from my experience and talking with others.
Well, sure. I mean, here's this thing that you've done that's basically saved your life, which is admit that you're an addict and admit it to a bunch of other people. And then now you kind of start living this new life and you think, okay, well, this same thing. And I experienced that on the level of being a Christian and being in those Christian communities. Mm-hmm. You know, I step into like a men's group environment. We know it's just a bunch of guys who are going to church and not necessarily in recovery. And so I step into that kind of like with this transparency, ready to like air out all my dirty laundry.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm like, that works. And the people are like, they're not ready for that.
Yeah. But even in a group, in a Christian group. Yeah.
You know, they still think, this is what happens in Christian groups, is men will say things like, well, you know, I just watch things I shouldn't watch. It's like, nah, man, you watching porn.
Mm-hmm.
Just say you watching porn.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I just, you know, I do things and say things. What are you talking about? What do you do? What do you say?
Yeah.
But I guess that's the gift and the curse. At least that's what I tell people who are in recovery. It's like, we have this curse, but we also have this gift that we have to maintain this level of honesty, rigorous honesty with others.
You're saying that's a curse for you?
I'm saying there's a gift and a curse.
Okay.
Being an addict is the curse, right?
Is it?
Well, it's two sides is what I'm saying, right? There's a significant portion of my life as an addict that looks really much like a curse,
mm-hmm.
right? Could have been a lot worse.
Sure.
That's the curse, right? That's also the thing that I got to rebuild my life. You know, I'm 40-something years old. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm still learning about myself and who I am as a... So there's some downside. But the positive side is I have to be rigorously honest, because if I'm not, then my dysfunction is going to turn up in the form of, you know, abusing some kind of chemical or alcohol, and it has a propensity to burn everything down. Whereas somebody who maybe only has, or someone who has an issue of maybe pride or a little bit of greed, That's not so obvious. You can't really see that in the mirror. And society's not going to point their finger at you. They're actually going to probably applaud you for having a bunch of money and being somebody of status. So, but I do agree, like, or what we try to do here on the show is say, we like you to have a year before you would come on and share your story, you know, for that reason. Like, I don't want to put that pressure on somebody.
Yeah.
You know? So, so you mentioned you did cognitive behavioral therapy.
Well, hold on. I want to go back to what, okay. I want to go back to what you just said. That's good. By. I mean, that's good stuff. Cause you know, you mentioned that I gotta collect my thoughts for a sec.
Yeah.
Cause you mentioned that people in recovery or people with this like, consciousness about themselves and being like rigorously honest are maintaining this standard, right?
Yeah.
And they have to maintain it. And people outside of that, right, don't, or they don't have to. So, and society judges them. But who's judging you? Like, who's judging the people in recovery? Is that an internal thing? That's like an internal judgment, you know, like it's more of a, and I hear this a lot. I hear like, where does that come from? Because before, a lot of people most people don't have that awareness. They don't have that consciousness before they get sober. And then they get sober and they start, this consciousness is kind of like, boom, it like they wake up, right? They're awoken.
Yeah.
And the critical part of themselves and their, you know, shame, guilt, all this stuff, if they want to call it that, they're very critical about themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that a lot of people who aren't in recovery have that too, but I think a lot of people in recovery do it a lot more.
Yeah.
Right. They're very critical about themselves. So, yeah, I do agree with you about what are the downsides of what would happen to someone if they go back out. You know, it's more destructive. But I think that people in recovery who are more critical of themselves and have that consciousness don't exactly. Their likelihood and their chances of going back out are lower, right? If they have that that connection and their ability to see themselves, their chances of using again are lower.
Yeah, and I also think that you could take it to an extreme, right? Where, and I've done this, where everything can't be okay. Something's got to be wrong, you know, and. Which I think is taking it too far to the other end. You know, it's like my dean at the seminary, she sent me a letter, and it's like a portion of this, of the process where they call it, you know what they call it, challenge or something like that, and or the final stretch or something. And that was her stretch because she hears me talk. She's also a part of 12 Step and, you know, and this interfaith community. So I have the perfect dean for me, but I did kind of receive what she was saying. Like, you know, I hear you talk about yourself in such a negative way. So I think that's also part of my own recovery journey is to get to this point, being rigorously honest about who you are, your flaws, your character defects, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be, you're continually like shitting on yourself. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like there's a balance, a delicate balance to that. And, you know, like in the Christian community, they don't like that, you know, I would call myself an addict, you know, and because they think I'm like, you know, I guess claiming something that I'm not no longer, I'm beyond that or something. What do you think is the power in that? Like for those of us who are in recovery, what do you think is the power in that saying and not even saying it publicly, but just in recovery community of admitting that you're an addict and doing that kind of continually, kind of you could have 20 years in and someone says, I'm an addict or I'm alcoholic. What do you see as the advantages or disadvantages of that?
Well, it's admitting that you have no control. Mm-hmm. For just at the ground level, that we could talk about this. We could make a whole podcast episode about this. But
yeah.
I think that the most basic answer is that it allows people to realize that they don't have control, that they don't have the ability to control their using and their drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that, people will look back on their use. They will look back on their drinking and they will question, why weren't things different?
Right.
Why weren't things controllable? You know, and they'll, questioning one thing in the past can really make you, like, if you question, like, why were things not different then? Like, why couldn't I have changed, that DUI? Like, why, if I didn't get that DUI, I wouldn't be where I am now. And, but you're sober, right? Like, if you question those things in the past, then are you really an addict?
Right.
Are you really an alcoholic?
Mm-hmm.
So questioning those things, is really bad for alcoholics and addicts. But really looking back on those things and understanding that you're powerless over them is the basis of it.
Right.
But I guess in the moment, I don't know. That's a really good question. I'd have to think about it a little bit more.
Well, I like what you're saying about that, like by saying like, oh yeah, that's why I got a DUI. Because I'm an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why I didn't save any money those 10 years I was using cocaine.
Yeah.
Because I'm a drug addict. Yeah. You know, it makes sense now. Oh, yeah, cool. I get it. But there is a point, right? And the 12-step program admits to this, right? There's a point you get where you that obsession is no longer a part of your life,
mm-hmm.
right? Where like a majority of my issues today are character defects that I'm dealing with and trying to manage. I'm trying to grow as a human. I don't sit around every day obsessing over drugs and alcohol like I did, right? But yet when I come into a room or I go into these environments, I say I'm an addict,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I guess like what I try to explain to Christians, I'm gonna use this as an opportunity to say this, I don't know if I've ever said it on the podcast, but you know, it's, at some point, you begin referring to yourself as an addict, no longer as much for yourself, but for the other person in the room, you know? And when you're in those rooms, and a guy's in there, and he's been there 2 days, and he's just drying out, and you're there, and you got your shit a little bit together, you look like somebody who might be enjoying life, and you stand up and you go, I'm an addict. Then maybe that person might go, oh, and there's might be hope for me.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes less about, I'm not describing, it's less of a thing of like, woe is me, I'm an addict. It's more like, look, I'm an addict and look, I'm alive. I'm living these promises, right? Defects.
Well, you know, a lot of people who get, I say that a lot. I don't know why the hell I say that. Like a lot of people, but I've heard a lot that
less
people get sober. This might not be everyone's experience, but they were such shitty people they get crappy people, right? And they get sober and they're not crappy people anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Or they want to experience not like being way better.
Yeah.
And then they uncover like there's a lot of the same traits that when they were using and drinking. And they start to experience that when they start to uncover these shortcomings, right? These character defects. And that can be really uncomfortable for people. And talking to people, they experience that. They experience, man, these things are like, I thought this stuff was just going to go away. I thought,
right.
And what does that mean? What would it mean if you didn't have any shortcomings? What would it mean if you were going to have any character defects?
Right.
You'd be perfect. Right?
Yeah. You wouldn't be human.
Yeah.
You'd be a chair
or a rock. And I think people like strive for to not have defects of character or to really see those things be different in their lives, but really there's almost like this, shortcomings are like this, they're an asset for people in a sense, because when you notice a shortcoming or a character defect in your life, you realize that it's not going away or that it's not completely fixable. So yeah. What do?
Right. It helps you to stay rigorously honest. Right?
Yeah. And it helps you turn to what has fixed your problem.
Right.
It turns your attention towards God. It turns your attention towards your higher power.
Right.
Or that's what it's designed to do, right? That's what the 12 steps are designed to do.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really this kind of beautiful process. And, but I don't think it's always looked at that way. It's not, and that's normal, I think, because to really want things to be better and to be fixed, they're internalized as something that, you know, I can fix. Like, I want this to go away.
Right.
And to really control and have fear and fear about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think the character defects do point us. There's a point, though, our character defects are harmful.
Sure.
To others, right? The way we treat people or talk to people. But I know some people I know who have really long term, like 20 to 30 years. One thing I think that's different about them is they don't judge themselves so harshly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they surely have character defects. They surely are a pain in the ass to be around, you know, at some point in time, you know, but they just don't seem to judge themselves about that.
Yeah,
you know?
They give themselves a break. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that you're really kind of hit on that. Like, we think just because these things are still showing up, and then we want to judge it, you know, pass this judgment down on it. Like, oh, that's bad. You're bad. You're not moving on. But then also, for me personally, you know, at this, you know, there was a point in my recovery around 5 or 6 years where I just kind of started going, well, what the hell, man? Like, I should not be this miserable, right? I'm not using. Why am I miserable? And so that was the thing that pointed me back to the solution. It pointed me right back to it because it said, hey, if you're, you know, somebody pointed out the promises of one of the 12-step groups, and I was reading the promises, and I go, damn, I got one. I'm not feeling one of those. I'm sure I do have them. But it forced me back in. It forced me to say, all right, I got to start addressing, you know, because I had kind of fallen out of that rigorous pursuit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, character defects are, and then it's also really easy to spot character defects in someone else.
Sure.
Right? So how do you, like, when you have people coming in who are dealing with these character defects, at some point you move past kind of the triage stage of, like, let's just get it to where you're not risking jail or...
Yeah, stabilizing someone.
Yeah. Someone's gotten to that stable part. Now it's time to start talking about these character defects. Mm-hmm. You know, like, what do you find are some of the ways, like, as you're talking through that seem to really get people to a place of freedom or...
Well, I like to really just, I like to normalize things for people. You know, when you talked about stable, you know, if someone's stable, you know, they're not wanting to harm themselves or mm-hmm. harm someone else or do something really risky, you know, that I like to really just normalize this stuff for people because I believe that they're not normalizing it for themselves.
Right.
Right. And what they hear in society, what they hear a lot of times from family and maybe friends and social media
mm-hmm.
is that it's not normal. They're not normal.
Mm.
And you could define that all you want, but really just normalizing that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's what, I think that's what people need. Right.
Yeah.
And to really just help them with shame and guilt. People carry that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And minimizing that stuff. Because that does a lot for people.
Yeah. Well, it's like that, what they say, like when you get in recovery, the good thing is you get your feelings back. And the bad thing is you get your feelings back.
Sure.
So you start feeling these things that for the last so many years, your primary function in life was to rid yourself of those feelings. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I like that word normalize in that sense. It's humanize. You sure. know, it's like, yeah, you should feel sad in some situations. It's the absolutely appropriate response mm-hmm. to certain things, like a sense of remorse or a sense of kind of, you know, lamenting or kind of mourning, even if it's not someone that's died, you know, but mm-hmm. kind of like processing guilt, you know, that's going to probably suck. But the idea that you could say, hey, normalizing, you're humanizing it to say it's going to suck and that's okay, right? Like that, you ever heard that saying, it's okay if you're not okay? You just yeah. can't stay that way. Yeah. Yeah. So is that kind of what you're getting at? Am I hearing you right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Very interesting. Because I think that's a...
Because I think a lot of... Inversely, I think people say to themselves, like, it's not okay if I'm not okay, right? So, like, for instance, if someone's, like, not feeling good about something, if they're judging themselves, if they feel bad, they might be telling themselves, I shouldn't be feeling bad about this, right? Yeah. So, it's like, you stack emotions. And right. You stack, like, this is like metacognition, right? You're, like, thinking about thinking. Yeah. Thinking about why you shouldn't be thinking a certain way.
Yeah.
And people, a lot of times, maybe don't realize that.
Yeah.
They don't realize that they judge themselves based on how they feel. Like, they judge themselves. There's, you know, they should or shouldn't be feeling a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they have these expectations for how they feel, right?
Yeah.
And maybe they're not meeting that. So then they feel a certain way about that.
Right.
And that's kind of heady, but that's what's happening.
Yeah.
That's what people are experiencing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in one of the religions we studied and tried to practice was Buddhism. And Buddhism, I felt like, had a lot of insight into that kind of mm-hmm. process. And the way the seminary is, you spend a month in and then you got to go to another religion. But I found the concepts in Buddhism to be somewhat, like, something about them was true, but they were also, they're Eastern, right? Which is, I didn't grow up with that kind of thought, right? I think us in America are a little more binary, right? When in the Eastern philosophies are a little less like that, right? Like the yin and the yang, where there's light in the darkness, there's darkness in the light, right? Mm-hmm. There's really no that judgment concept. But one of the things is, like, and I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but it's, there's this saying where it says, like, you know, the Buddhist knows what it's doing. Like, we're paying attention, so when we're walking, we know we're walking.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even a thing where it says that most humans don't live in a state of consciousness, that we're living in an unconscious state
mm-hmm.
most of the time, and that there are certain things that'll bring us into consciousness, right? Like, you know, somebody comes in and slaps their hands, someone's just banging pots and pans in here, we're going to become very aware of where we are and what we're doing. But in most cases, it's like you said, these emotions that are stacked up is reacting, and it's this domino effect. And before I know it, I'm pissed off in the car, you know, popping open a bottle of Jack or something. And it's like, well, how the hell did I get here? Mm-hmm. And it's because without that course correct, that kind of bringing you back into consciousness, right? Which would be a meeting, which would be calling somebody, which would be listening to something like this, maybe, hopefully, you know, that kind of brings you back to consciousness to realize I'm an addict. Yes. Okay. That's right. I'm here. And then the other thing was that you're not your thoughts, right? And to create space between you and your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
That's also was really like a profound teaching. So here's a teaching that's very, very old, you know, but would have been very useful for me.
Yeah.
Like, early on, to be able to kind of get that concept of not being so judgmental and being able to create space between me and my thoughts and my feelings. So,
do you think it's okay to be judgmental towards yourself?
I mean, guess it would be judgmental if I said it was or wasn't.
Well, I mean, like, I think that's another thing, like, right? So we were just kind of talking about that, and I think that that's a normal process.
Yeah.
It's normal to, like, judge yourself, and people have that thought process that, like, I shouldn't be judging myself, right? Yeah. And the more people notice what's going on with themselves,
yeah,
right, they, the more they're awake to what's happening,
yeah,
the less they will then have those judgments,
right,
and they'll just start to notice what they're thinking, yeah, and the feelings they're having,
yeah,
and that can be really uncomfortable,
yeah,
that can be really uncomfortable, because then you start to notice, like, that there's actually society norms and culture influences on you, yeah, right? Like, you have this, for instance, maybe it comes along with, I'll use the example of death, right? Like, mm-hmm, I've heard this a lot with men in therapy. Maybe they have a close one die, and mm-hmm, a loved one die, and they don't cry, you know? And they feel like they should be emotional, and they judge that part of themselves. So, like, yeah, why am I not crying? And they get angry about not crying, yeah, right? So then there's this society norm that you should cry or be emotional.
Yeah.
So that's a norm in society.
Right.
But is that right or wrong? Who created that? So you start to notice these societal, cultural things that have been kind of placed on us.
Right.
Right. And yeah, that can be uncomfortable, because then you start to notice a lot of them.
Yeah.
And then you have to kind of distinguish, like, are they right or wrong? And you start to notice them in a lot of areas of your life.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because, you know, both Jesus and Buddha were kind of responses to the societal norm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were both kind of rebelling against the societal norm.
Sure.
Saying, like, this is how you're doing it. Well, this is, you know, so that's very interesting. But that's layers deep, man. Like, people don't exist at that level. People are just trying to pay rent. You know what I mean? Like, so it's like they're not considering.
It's because culture's deep.
Yeah. Right. There's the term, somebody said that culture trumps ideology, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we can go and have, like, an amazing spiritual experience, and then you come home and you're two hours in and you're cussing and you've lost the whole thing, because your culture is like, well, then there's even the culture of the house. Like, I just noticed that we had a great week out, and then I was a few days back at the house, and I realized, wow, there's a culture in my house that somehow replaced what I found to be true in this spiritual experience that I had.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So there's, like, there's culture within this greater culture, you know, that we create these kind of environments. And I think we can become conscious of that. We can become aware of that. I think the 12 steps is a great means to get you there.
Sure.
Where you can kind of look at it and go, you know what, let's change that. Let's make it, what do we want to make it? And that you have that option. You can do that. You can change your situation, your circumstances, your culture, and how you respond to culture, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough, because it's everywhere. You know, it's you can't get away from it. You know, I think people try. People,
yeah,
when they're exposed to so much of it, you hear about people all the time, like, moving away, like, moving to Montana, you know, like, you know, buying a bunch of land and, like, leaving, or, like, trying to get away from culture. And I don't think there's any way to get away. There's no way to just, yeah, to not be exposed to some form of,
yeah,
you can try, right? But it's always there somehow.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a lot why I picked going to an interfaith seminary. You know, I mean, I've had a real spiritual experience with Jesus. And so, you know, that's who I talk to. That's who kicks it with me. But I just, I don't fit into cultural Christianity, you know, and I don't like it. Actually, I freaking hate it. You know, it annoys me. And I wanted an authentic experience, you know. And
what about you? I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What about your experience doesn't fit in with cultural Christianity?
Well, so I think part of it is moving here from the West Coast. In the South, there's a certain Christian. This is how you Christian. You do these certain things, right? Mm-hmm. You go to the church on Sunday, and maybe you go on Wednesday, and then when the church youth group goes out, you send the kids on that. And this is how you do church. This is how you do Christian. And so you can exist in that environment and have no life transformation. And essentially, you're no different than you were when you first started. In my study of Christianity, my study of Jesus and his teachings, and the whole concept of an incarnated God, there's transformation is expected, you know? So that's the thing that's probably rubs me the most, is stepping into that and kind of going, you know, there's no transformation, there's no growth, you know, or friction. So that's why I picked that, because the Interfaith Seminary, because they were able to give me kind of we're looking at everything. Mm-hmm. No one fits in here. You know what I mean? Like, nobody fits in, because we're looking at everything. And 1 month you may be like, oh my gosh, I get it, I fit in. And then the teacher shows up and you're like, oh no, nope, I don't fit in here either. You know? Yeah. So no one fits in, everyone fits in. It's this kind of really cool a situation. But that's the thing, is like, we're talking about culture, man. It's like, I don't feel like I'm smart enough to really talk about it, but it just is everywhere, you know. And if you're not careful, man, it'll swallow you up. And you know, you'll find yourself 70 something years old laying on bed going, what the hell was that? This is not my beautiful wife. And the days go by, water flowing.
What's that? Right.
That's why art's so important, right? Because seems to capture these things. Mm-hmm. All right, so here's the deal. If you've listened this far in and you're hearing my voice, mm-hmm. now, Brian will give you a free counseling session. Free, I'll pay for it. And you can just holler at me at contact@themosthighshow. And we'll hook you up if you got this far. But you got to email me, and supplies limited. All right. That's it. This is the Most High Show.